those willing to sit here and open to the light. The light that shines equally on a sunny day or a rainy day. The light that is incapable of resisting anything by its very nature. Therefore, there's great incentive for us in Sesshin to open to the non-resisting light, because we might be resisting what's happening. Can we trust this light that doesn't know how to resist anything? It is complete openness. It struck me when we were chanting this morning the hymn to Prajnaparamita. Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is usually considered the second turning of the Dharma wheel, emphasizing emptiness of all things. But there's also the third turning of the Dharma wheel, emphasizing the presence of this empty space. The light, if the second turning is more about not finding anything, not being able to find anything, the third turning is more about radiant light illuminating everything equally and completely. So that chant this morning struck me as kind of a hidden third turning of the Dharma wheel in the second turning sutra, because we say she is a source of light. And from everyone in the triple world, in all of the appearance of samsara, she removes darkness. Most excellent are her works. I think her works, particularly all these volumes of Prajnaparamita sutras, they come out in this form of sutras. They're not really, the Prajnaparamita sutras are not really Prajnaparamita herself. They're just her works, most excellent works.
What's the first turning?
Oh, the first turning of the Dharma wheel is the basics. There is suffering. There is the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path we chanted this morning called setting in motion the wheel of Dharma. So that's the first turning. Second is that actually there's actually not really suffering. There's not really an origin of suffering. There's not really a cessation of suffering. And there's not really a path. And we could say the third turning of the Dharma wheel is that suffering is actually made of light. And the origin of suffering is made of light. And cessation of suffering is also light, and the path is light. So in this session, of course, we're celebrating the light, the transmission of light. So from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness. Most excellent are her works. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken, and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She brings light. She's a source of light. Really, even, she is the light. And then, I think most striking this morning to me was, she herself is an organ of vision. So she is the light, but she is the knowing of the light, right? That's what an organ of vision is. She's the source of light, and she's the knowing of the light. She is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge, knowing of the true nature of all things. She doesn't stray away from it. And she, this light, actually sets in motion all the wheels of Dharma turning. The first, second, and third turnings, she is really setting them all in motion. So, Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is also the light and the knowing of the light, the vision of the light. And here's just one more I came across recently. Prajnaparamita, second turning of the Dharma wheel teaching, that sounds really like this light of Buddha nature that we're celebrating. This is not just, not just about negating everything, right? Prajnaparamita sutras, like the Heart Sutras, emphasizing no body, no mind, and so on. This is from the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita. The Buddha says, "The mind of the Buddha never ceases, and it was never produced. It has no duration in between production and stopping. The mind of Buddha, it gives no support for anything to hold on to. It's infinite, measureless, inexhaustible, like the whole cosmos itself. This is the mind of Buddha." The Tathagata knows that the minds of all beings are transparently luminous. Prabhasvara, meaning their light or luminosity in their essential original nature. The Buddha knows that the minds of all sentient beings are transparently luminous, light in their essential original nature. It's just a little excerpt from the sutra, but celebrating the light in Prajnaparamita. Trusting the light, whatever possible state we are in any moment of this day of sitting, can we trust the organ of vision, the knowing light, the knowing of the light, that it cannot resist or grasp anything, and is here with us. It's the true nature of all our experience. And as I mentioned yesterday, this, if we're having an experience any moment, which we seem to be any moment that we're conscious and awake, we're having an experience, right? So if we're having an experience, I'd understand that this knowing awareness, the light, is saying yes to this experience. It's allowing it. If the light, the all-inclusive light of awareness, didn't say yes to this experience of, say, pain or pleasure or anything else, then the experience would not be possible. Because the experience is actually made of the light. The light is manifesting as this experience. So it is always saying yes. Even if I am saying, I can't stand this any longer, this experience is too painful or boring or whatever. It's our true nature is actually saying yes to it and actually manifesting it, making the experience possible. You might say, well, why would it do that if it's a painful experience? And I think it's just because the light of awareness is open to cause and effect. And every experience that we're having is arising due to conditions. Nothing is random, right? Pain and pleasure are arising due to many conditions. And awareness is open to this display of cause and effect. Awareness is willing to manifest as the appearance of cause and effect, the appearance of pain and pleasure. So that's one story about the light. Yeah.
Yeah, there's these personifications of things, like you say, is willing.
Yeah.
And part of it is she.
Yes.
I'm intrigued by this.
Yeah. I'm intrigued by them too. Yeah.
I don't know what the make of them.
You're right. It's like, in a way, I think it's not really that Prajnaparamita is of the female gender, for example, and that awareness is saying yes. It's not literally like it has some intention or personification. So I think it is a somewhat poetic way of speaking. But I think it's beautiful that Prajnaparamita is generally portrayed as the feminine. And maybe this is because she's completely open and willing to receive anything. The feminine is kind of like receptivity, at least in kind of Chinese systems. We have yin and yang, right? Yang is kind of like the active movement force, and yin is kind of like the open receptivity.
Aren't we receiving the Prajnaparamita, or is the wisdom? I mean, it seems like the light is something you receive.
Both. We receive and we are the light. Mm-hmm. She's an organ of vision, is like receiving, and she's a source of light, is she's giving.
Also intriguing that something that's willing to be experienced is possible not to experience. I think that's intriguing. Like people resist, right?
Well, but resistance doesn't actually block it, right? We try to. like there's a pain, a physical pain in Sashin, or I wish this would stop, I really can't. But it actually doesn't make it go away. That's the kind of irony of it, yeah. Is that if it did, if by resisting something we actually made it stop, then we would promote resistance as our prime practice. But in fact, it doesn't actually work. Sometimes temporarily it stops something, but generally we promote the practice of just openness to everything, which is very counterintuitive when something's unpleasant. But that's, I understand that Prajnaparamita is always that way. And she is our nature. She is who we are too. So there's our true nature is not resisting the pain. But there's this appearance of me, the small self, limited person. I'm resisting the pain. So all these teachings of Zen seem to be constantly pointing back to opening to and discovering this true nature that's always at ease and not capable of resisting at the same time that we're resisting. That's what non-duality is all about. If it were like, well, first I got to stop resisting and then I'll be able to see Prajnaparamita, then that's a kind of dualistic practice. We got to stop this to get this. But this is more like she's shining through the resistance. She's shining through the pain. She's shining through everything. Yes.
So, I mean, probably the way I usually think of it is more from a cosmological or a physics point of view of just accepting the idea that we live in the context of an ununderstandable infinity. So, in a sense, once you make that acceptance, which is mysterious, but it still is not deniable, then all this naturally comes from it. Everything, except that we're talking about it in somewhat poetic terms, in terms of the latent pregnancy or whatever of the Tao, who can bring forth whatever sounds feminine.
I think all of these ways are different angles on it, and we talked yesterday too about not knowing, and that's true. I think not knowing is, especially when we're talking about trying to figure out how this even came to be, and also knowing even things in exactly as they are, the conventional appearances to know and understand the workings of everything, that we can't really know. But then there's this other kind of knowing that is the knowing of Prajnaparamita. She's an organ of vision. So that kind of knowing, but that's not knowing something, and it's not knowing a fact. It's not knowing anything conceptually, but it's the knowing of awareness that is awake. So it's just, I like the word knowing in this context because we can also paint a picture of, well, there's just the cosmos, the interdependently arising stuff, and we're just stuff that's part of that, and it kind of takes the life somehow out of it, somehow, for me, if we just see it like, and if we're gone, then there's no more awareness of anything, but the rocks and the pebbles are still functioning. I'd say that takes some, I think there's still life there, and this life I would call, that's what I mean by knowing. Even if there's not what we call sentient beings, I think when we say, is this at the end of the universe when everything, all sentient beings are destroyed, is this destroyed or not? And some of the Zen ancestors said, not, it's not destroyed.
It seems like that's, if the infinite is something that unknowingly we allow, then everything is possible and everything is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is inevitable. Everything. So that's the no. You can't say no because
everything that's happening is inevitable.
And everything that isn't happening, because if it has infinite time to happen, it will. I mean, it's kind of the cosmic view of looking at it. So you don't have to worry because whatever it is, it will happen and has happened.
So even these Zen ancestors in India were born and told these stories. So seems to be like happening.
Seems to be.
So the fourth ancestor was the venerable Upagupta, and we chant his name as Ubakikuta Daiyosho, which is one of my favorite ones to pronounce. Ubakikuta.
Ubakikuta.
Ubakikuta Daiyosho, Ubakikuta Daiyosho, Ubakikuta Daiyosho. The fourth ancestor was Venerable Upagupta. He attended Shanavasa for 3 years, then shaved his head and became a monk. Once Shanavasa asked him, "Did you leave home physically or in spirit?" Leave home is one of, shuke is this word for becoming a monk. And Ubakikuta replied, "Truly, I left home physically." And Shanavasa said, "How can the wondrous Dharma of the Buddhas have anything to do with body or mind?" On hearing this, Ubakikuta was greatly awakened. That's the story. And then a little bit about Upagupta's life. The master was from the land of Dali, and his name was Upagupta. Have you heard about the land of Dali? It's where all the clocks are dripping. It's a kind of timeless realm. He belonged to the Shudra class, which is the peasant class, the lowest of the four castes in India. At the age of 15, he visited Shanavasa. At 17, he left home, and at 22, he realized the fruit of practice. Traveling about and helping others open to Buddha, he arrived at Mathura, and the number of those who were liberated was extremely great. So actually it says Tokudo here, which literally means attaining salvation. We have Shuke Tokudo ceremony, like leaving home and attaining salvation. And we have Zaike Tokudo, which we just did with Kigen-san the other day. It was a Zaike Tokudo, literally meaning like staying at home and attaining the way, not the way, salvation. Sometimes San Francisco Zen Center, it somehow it started sticking to call it attaining the way, because I think somebody didn't look at the Chinese character, because Do means the way, but another Do character means to cross over or to save, and it's the second one that's the written form. So attaining liberation or salvation, when we say I vow to save all beings, it's this character. So one translator says the number of those who became monks with Upagupta was great, and the other translation says those who attained salvation with him were exceedingly great. And maybe he's playing with this whole term, because it's part of the story. As a result of all this salvation happening, the palace of a demon shook and trembled, and the demon grieved and was afraid. So a demon here is like Mara. You know, Mara, who comes and disturbs the Buddha. Each time someone verified the fruit of awakening, Upagupta tossed a tally 4 inches in length into a stone room. So I guess like a little like wooden like tally marker. He was keeping track of how many people were awakened, and he tossed them into this room. The room was 18 cubits high and 12 cubits square, and was filled with tallies. One tally is about 2 feet. They're big tallies. These are just part of this old Indian stories are like this, right? So he's filling this stone room with these tallies, and the whole room, like the size of the Zendo or something, was piled full of these tallies. In other words, many people were awakening to the light, practicing with him. When Upagupta, after he died, he was cremated by burning all these tallies accumulated from a lifetime of salvation of many beings. So that's kind of a weird little story about Upagupta. But maybe we could say, what's the point of such a story? And you could say, he was doing this like kind of keeping track thing with these tallies, and during his lifetime, but when his body ended and he returned to the light, then this keeping track, all this, manifestation of his life, they used these tallies to make the cremation pyre and burn them, to burn his body. So it's kind of like, I hear it as all of the kind of marks and signs from the successes of his life, and we could say the failures of his life too. Everything burned up with that life. Nothing's left, and then it's like a fresh start, in a new form of light, whatever happened to him after. So same with us, right? All our tallies that we're piling up in our stone houses over this lifetime, it will all turn into ashes along with us at the end.
How does the thought feel that, given again the infinite context, inevitably everything is saved? Nothing cannot be saved. This is the same kind of yes you were saying.
So
since we have infinity to play with.
Oh, over time, yeah.
Nothing will not be saved.
Mm-hmm. That's the spirit of the Lotus Sutra, where the Buddha's making all these predictions. Everyone will be a Buddha, even the most karmically hindered beings, over time. But he didn't say like they all became Buddhas right then and there, because then it'd be too many tallies.
There's no play.
Yeah. So it's kind of saying that there is awakening, and there is being caught up in delusion, and eventually, all beings will be awake. That's the Mahayana, that's the faith of the Mahayana. The number of people who left home with Upagupta was as great as when the Tathagata was alive. Therefore, people called him the Buddha without the major and minor marks of a Buddha. Like, he didn't have wheel marks on his hands and things like that. So the demon, remember there's this demon involved here, like Mara, which again I understand always as an aspect of our own mind. Again, it's a kind of personification thing. In the Buddha's sutras, the Buddha talks about Mara's, on the night of Buddha's enlightenment is where Mara's getting super strong, right? You could say his own unresolved, unconscious, self-centeredness.
Ego.
Yeah, ego. His own unresolved, unconscious ego, self-centeredness is like when Buddha's about to completely open to reality, those tendencies start flaring up. And we might notice that too in Sesshin, right? The more settled we get, the more all this sludge, Mara sludge starts coming up and preventing our peace.
Fighting for its life, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but then I always thought it was interesting in the Buddha Sutras that later in the Buddha's life, after he was supposedly the completely unsurpassed awakened one, still near the end of his life, Mara made some more appearances, came back and said, you've done enough good work in this life. You can go now, but you can die now, Buddha. And the Buddha's like, not yet, Mara. Actually, there's a few more things I have to do. So again, I could hear that he's really old and tired, and his unconscious is saying, you've done enough, but his true spirit is saying, wait, just to, you know, I'll go, but just a little bit more still. So in this case, it's Ubhakupta and his own unresolved, unconscious, self-centered tendencies, we could say here. We could hear it this way. So this demon, resentful of Upagupta's good works, watched for a time when Upagupta entered samadhi. Then, exercising all his demonic powers, he tried to harm the true Dharma. That's basically Mara's job. Upagupta, while in samadhi, saw what was intended. So in his meditative state, he could see his negativity arising, and he saw what was about to happen, that the demon's trying to prevent the true Dharma manifesting through Upagupta. So the demon watched and secretly hung a garland around Upagupta's neck. Then Upagupta had the idea of subduing him. So it doesn't explain the metaphors of this strange, really ancient stories, but I could hear this as maybe this garland is something to do with like vanity. It's like this decoration and like maybe Upagupta's pride, right? So he's doing all this great stuff, but he still has some sense of self-pride, say. And the demon comes and puts this flower garland over him as a kind of an offering. So Upagupta's like, ah, nice. And then he kind of catches it and says, I gotta stop this demon. And so, rising from samadhi, Upagupta took the dead bodies of a human, a dog, and a snake and transformed them into a flower garland. These old stories are admittedly very strange. And it doesn't say anything about why these three creatures, right? And then speaking gently to the demon, he put the demon at ease, saying, you offered me a very rare and wonderful garland, and now I have a garland which I want to offer you in return. The demon was very happy and extended his neck to receive it. Then the garland changed back into three smelly corpses. Insects and worms crawled from them. The demon detested it and was greatly distressed. He could not get rid of it despite all his supernatural powers, nor could he unfasten it or move it. What's going on here? So, something maybe too about when we're working with our demons, it's good to talk gently to them. Like, if we kind of fight back and like, how dare you put a flower garland on my neck? Or, you know, how dare you accuse me of being arrogant and vain? We might say, go away. I'm not that way. I don't want this flower garland. Maybe like this. But instead it's like, no, I see you, demon of of arrogance. And I do want to make an offering back to you. I'm not just messing with you here. We could hear it as it's a secret ploy, right? He's messing with the demon. But we could also hear it as, no, sincerely, I do want to make this offering to show you something, demon, and I'm going to use these rotting corpses that are not beautiful and will not make you feel proud, Mara. So, and Mara, the demon, did not like this. Like, this is not like the kind of garland I was hoping for. I was hoping for some reward for giving you, Upagupta, some nice flowers to make you feel good.
When he put them on, there were flowers, right?
I heard he put them on, there were flowers, and they immediately turned back into the...
Maybe just a bad environment, and the flowers couldn't...
Yeah, they just immediately rotted.
That's like...
Yeah. Some flowers start stinking when they rot. So maybe like that. I don't know why, particularly a dog, a human, and a snake either.
By giving flowers to Mara, he's being nice to the... You're saying, be nice with your challenges?
Yeah.
Offering flowers?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that turn sort of goes against that idea a little bit.
That it's nice?
Yeah,
well,
that's a part of it.
It could, but maybe it could also be this could be another way of working with our demons, is that we'll kindly offer them something, but we're also using skillful means. So I do want to offer you something, but I want to show you something about yourself, Mara, and about your relationship with me. So in fact, he's not really actually harming or poisoning Mara, I hear, with these rotting corpses. It's more just really shaking up the demon. This is just, I really don't like this. And therefore it's something also about, again, this doesn't mention any commentary about this story really, so I'm just thinking about this on my own, but thinking of maybe something to do with this pride, this issue of vanity or pride, that's kind of... Upagupta is this great bodhisattva, right? And maybe this thing of throwing the tallies in the room that occurs to me right now is also kind of related to pride, right? Oh, these people that woke up due to me. Let's fill up the house full of... let's count them up and get credit for all of it, you know? And then Mara's here, take a flower garland for all your great work. And Upagupta sees that in his meditation, right? Wait a second, I don't want to be dragged down into this self-centered, separate self getting the credit for all this good work. It's not really me that's doing this work. It's the light. The light needs the credit. Homage to Prajnaparamita, the lovely, the holy. She is the one who is really awakening all these beings. And she's just using me, Upagupta, as a kind of conduit. Just a conduit. But the conduit is natural. We feel I want the credit. And so Mara gives us some credit. Here, have a nice flower garland. Upagupta's wait a second. I see the danger of this. Actually, it's maybe a little bit extreme to be fair to put these stinking corpses on a demon, but maybe it's a little bit Upagupta felt he had to really do something to subdue the demon, is how they talk about it, right? Kindly, but a kind of a strong teaching about attachment to maybe pride. So the story goes on that the demon detested this and couldn't get rid of it, right? So then the demon rose up to the six heavens of the realm of desire. So this is all part of Buddhist cosmology, these heaven realms, and spoke to the celestial beings. He also visited the Brahma heavens, even higher heavenly realms, to get advice from these devas seeking liberation, maybe liberation from this stinking necklace. The celestial being said, actually, Mara, this is a supernatural transformation done by a disciple of the Buddha who has these 10 powers to benefit beings. We, the devas, are rather ordinary beings, so what can we do about it? Like, we can't get this necklace off you either. The demon said, well then, what can I do? And the Brahma devas, celestial beings, told him to take refuge with Upagupta. Then he'd be able to get rid of the garland. They recited this verse in order to change his mind. The verses that devas are all singing to Mara. Go take refuge with Upagupta, the one who actually is causing you all this stinkiness. And the verse goes, the encouraging verse is, if you fall down because of the ground, you must use the ground to get up. If you try to get up without the ground, it's impossible. Which is a nice practice verse. And we could take it probably in all different ways, but I hear it as the ground is like the ground of reality from which everything arises. So if you fall down because of the ground, we might even say, if you're resisting the ground of reality, you're going to get into trouble and fall down. But if you fall down because of this ground, you must use the ground to get up. If you try to get up without using the ground of reality, it's impossible. And we could even say the ground of reality in this case is manifesting as this ancestor Upagupta, this awakened ancestor Upagupta. He is like, for Mara, he is the ground of reality. And if you fall down, meaning like you get this stinking corpses because Upagupta, the awakened Upagupta gave them to you, you have to use the awakened Upagupta to get back up again and be relieved of these corpses. If you try to get up without using your relationship to Upagupta and reality, it makes no sense or it's impossible. Do you follow that a little? I'm sort of interpreting these stories because the text doesn't do it.
Yeah, I kind of heard it as, so if I'm prideful or if I'm arrogant and I'm humiliated or brought to the ground, like humus, the earth, then I need humility or I need to be humble in order to pick myself back up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We fall down, and again, it's maybe sort of a resistance to humility. Is we're falling down because of resisting that ground of earth, and so now we have to use that humus and humility of earth to rise back up again. Yeah.
It's just sort of like you can't solve a problem by going around it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really straightforward.
Yep.
Trying to do all the things but the problem.
Yep. That's the most straight, however we interpret it, I think that's definitely the case. The most straightforward way is if we have a problem, you have to use that problem actually to get up. If you try to go around it or bypass it, it won't work. It's a little bit like the classic image of, I think it's a Sufi story, right, about I lost my watch. I'm looking for it at night under here. A friend comes up and says, "Well, do you think you lost it right exactly under the light?" And he says, "No, actually, I think I lost it over in that dark alley over there." "Well, then why are you looking here?" "Well, because the light's here." And like, this will not work. You will not find it where it's most easy to find it. You have to go back into the dark alley to find your watch. It's a little bit like if you fall down because of the ground, you must use the ground to get up. If you try to get up without the ground, it makes no sense. So just as a whatever these stories are helpful for Sasheen, you can take up, and whichever ones seem too abstract and strange, you can immediately forget about them. But this one you might be able to just take as a, the encouragement of, like you say, Jeff, not looking somewhere else to get out of this mess of discomfort that we're in. Which is also like not thinking that the light that's incapable of resisting is somewhere else and we'll find it sometime in the future. That one is who we actually are always. So the devas recited this verse to change the mind of the demon, and they said, return and seek liberation from a disciple of Buddha, Upagupta. Having received this instruction, the demon left the celestial mansion and in repentance paid homage at the feet of Venerable Upagupta. And Upagupta said, are you going to ever try to harm the Tathagata's true Dharma again? And the demon replied, I completely take refuge in the Buddha way and will forever cease what is not good. And Upagupta said, in that case, you have to actually say, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the demon king joined his palms together and pronounced the refuge formula 3 times, and the garland of stinking corpses fell off. The fable was finished. And then Mara, the demon of Mara, turned into a Dharma protector. I thought this was a nice footnote here. And I thought of this ceremony we did with Keegan, Rachel on Saturday, and for those who are at the ceremony, there's all these things that are repeated 3 times. Over and over, you're like, now having done this, having said this 3 times, will you continue this practice? And we say that 3 times too, right? It's almost tedious. I don't think it's so tedious, but we really get into this, right? And and the footnote says, in Indian Buddhist custom, to repeat a formula such as the 3 refuges 3 times was to make, in effect, a binding commitment similar to a legally binding document. To repeat something 3 times was thus a very serious form of promise or commitment. So it does have that feeling, but I actually never kind of heard it put that way as kind of maybe an Indian legal custom, which is from an ancient culture. But it kind of makes sense because you can say it once kind of thinking about something else, not really paying attention, but it's hard to not pay attention over and over again. Possible, but not as easy. So Mara actually was kind of integrated into Upagupta's being, it sounds like, you know, which his self-centered delusion was kind of absorbed back into his true light, taking refuge. In this way, Upagupta displayed the powerful effects of Buddha Dharma just as when the Tathagata was alive. When he was 17 years old and shaved his head, Shanavasa asked him, did you leave home physically or in spirit? So remember, this is the original story. And literally it says, was this a body shuke or a mind shuke? Was this bodily leaving home or mentally leaving home? Was it your body or mind leaving home? Kazan says, for Buddhists, there are basically two forms of leaving home, which are physical and mental. Leaving home physically means that they cast away attachments, leave their homes and birthplaces, shave their heads, put on black robes, don't have servants, and become monks or nuns, and make an effort to practice the way wholeheartedly throughout the 24 hours of each day. Whatever the time, they do not pass it in vain. They desire nothing else. They neither delight in life nor fear death. Their minds are as pure as the autumn moon. Their eyes are as clear as a bright mirror. They do not seek mind, nor do they hanker to see their true natures. They're not seeking for it as something separate or other than what's happening right now. They do not cultivate the holy truth, much less worldly attachments. In this way, they do not abide in the stage of ordinary people or cherish the rank of the wise and holy, but more and more become mindless people of the way. These are people who leave home in body. That's a description of the ideal monk, free from attachments to the world and spiritual attachments also. And just moving at ease through the world. Those who leave home in mind or in spirit do not shave their heads or wear monk's clothing, even though they live at home, that's zaike, and remain among worldly cares. They are like lotuses which are not soiled by the mud in which they grow, or jewels which are immune to contamination by dust. Even though there are karmic conditions, so they have spouses and children, they are not attached to them. They do not entertain attachment, worldly attachment, for even a moment, or covet anything. Like the moon suspended in the sky, like a pearl rolling around in a bowl, they live in the noisy city and see the one who is tranquil, the one who's not busy, the light. In the midst of the three realms of samsara, they clarify the fact that they actually dwell beyond time. They realize that exterminating the passions is a sickness, and that aiming for ultimate reality is wrong. They realize that both nirvana and samsara are illusions. Literally it says sky flowers, which are like the like floaters in your eye that look like they're actually flowers in the sky, but they're actually on your own eye. And they're not attached to either enlightenment or the passions or the kleshas. Bono, Mugon, Seigan Gaku, that we say, Seigando, Shujo Muhen Seigando, Bono Mujin Seigandan, Bono Mujin, the kleshas, Bono, are inexhaustible. I vow to don them, like cut through them. So it's maybe the wordplay here, because in Japanese it would be, they're not attached to bodai or bono. These are people who leave home in spirit. So that's a nice story for us in a lay practice place, isn't it? There's leaving home physically means you do this like priest ordination ceremony and this kind of thing, and you do these outer signs of shaving the head and putting on the robes, but that's leaving home in body, which is also has, you know, letting go of attachment. And then leaving home in spirit or in mind, you don't have these outer signs, and you live in the midst of the busy city, within family life and challenging situations, but you're still free. So that's, I think, a great example. And Keizan's, I think, just talking to a bunch of monks in his day, in his sesshin. So I think he's honoring this other path that it's not about these outer signs, actually. It's about the inner mind of letting go. Shanavasa. Maybe we stop. These two kinds of shuke, leaving home, and this is Shodo Harada Roshi, contemporary Zen teacher, and I thought this was a nice. A challenging but nice commentary on leaving home. He says, the mind of no worry and no anxiety, this is the difference between a truly left home person and one who's left home only in form. To worry about your life and what it will bring you is for people of the world. If a monk thinks in that way, even if she's wearing the robes of an ordained Buddhist, then he is still a person of the world and not a true monk. To be able to totally entrust, leaving everything up to the workings of the heavens. Only if you do true zazen will you be able to understand this state of mind. When we can live without great concern for our welfare, the food we need usually comes. He's saying, I, in this kind of simple temple in Japan, have never had a single day of not receiving food. If you're truly walking the path, living with only what you actually really need and truly practicing, you'll be able to stay alive and receive what you need. And I'd say, well, is this food enough? But in fact, it's a nice perspective because in a way, well, yeah, actually. I mean, it's raining now, so a roof is also nice, even in the balmy climate of Santa Cruz. We want to at least stay dry. But I thought that's, you know, it's a nice commentary on truly leaving home is where the mind of no worry and anxiety. Will I have enough? It's nice. It's a good reminder too when we see people, homeless people living on the street, because they're getting by actually, and we want to help them and hope that they can find shelter, but actually we're pretty far from that situation. Sometimes we might feel like I could be there at any moment, but in fact I think it takes a lot of kind of removing ourselves from the conditions of support that are always coming to us to really kind of end up on the street. Not that it can't happen, but I myself, I can worry about a lot of unnecessary stuff. When I look at it from this perspective, it's like, actually things are like, okay. There's many people in this world that really don't have enough. And part of the teaching here too is that if we're practicing, that we can't always get what we want. But if we try sometimes, we might find we do get what we need. We dedicate the merit of our practice to the complete opening to the light for all beings. And any beings that are connected with this siren entering the Zendo right now, may they find ease and comfort in whatever difficulty they're in. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.